M. Jackson, W266, DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
A Vatican tribunal weighing a financial fraud case has heard from Pope Francis from a secret recording. Jackie Quinn has details.
The broadcast of Pope Francis's own voice in the courtroom marked a new chapter in a trial that's already seen plenty of twists and turns. The conversation was with an accused cardinal over the Holy See's payments to free a nun held hostage by militants. Author and Vatican analyst Marco Politi calls this trial a mess.
Now we don't know whether the Pope has to come as witness in front of the court, which would be unbelievable.
He says
the power struggles within the church have become reckless. There is no more respect for the high authority of the Pope.
Vatican judges are trying to determine who, if anyone, is criminally responsible for losing tens of millions of euros in Vatican assets. I'm Jackie Quinn.
And I'm Ben Thomas, AP News.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. The long-term effects of Wisconsin's redistricting process were apparent in the November elections. A nonpartisan good government group says voters who feel overlooked should not give up. Mike Moen reports.
Democratic Governor Tony Evers won re-election, but Republicans maintained strong control over the legislature. Jay Heck of the group Common Cause points out that Evers maintains his veto power, but he says Republicans still carry a lot of weight, partly because they keep redrawing the maps to their advantage.
There were more votes cast for Democratic candidates statewide than Republican, but the contrast with the legislative elections in the state is so sharp, it almost makes laughable the idea that we have a true representative democracy.
Researchers have said that over the past decade, Wisconsin has produced among the most gerrymandered voting district maps in the country. Heck says voters should look ahead to next year's state Supreme Court election with the hope a less politicized court could eventually revisit the issue. And there could be legislation floated again next year to develop an independent redistricting process. In the meantime, he says the current maps allow a smaller percentage of voters to decide who controls the legislature, leaving other voters behind in fair representation.
Urban areas in Wisconsin have suffered a decline in the shared revenue from the state, even though those people pay taxes.
Heck says that means less support for schools, roads, and other public needs. Analysts say lawmakers representing these areas get packed into boundaries that ultimately diminish their voices at the state capitol. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
Plenty of people start something great in their 40s and 50s. Getting your retirement savings on track is no different. Go to aceyourretirement.org and in 3 minutes you'll get personalized tips to help boost your retirement savings. That's aceyourretirement.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
My Alzheimer's diagnosis was hard to take,
but early detection allowed us to take control of the situation together.
Talk to your family about seeing a doctor. Go to alz.org/time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
MyShiro always goes the extra mile, stretches every dollar, puts others first. But now it's your time, Mom. Get free tips to help boost your retirement savings now at aceyourretirement.org.
Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
What grows in the forest? Trees? Sure. Know what else grows in the forest? Our imagination, our sense of wonder, and our family bonds grow too. Because when we disconnect from this and connect with this, we reconnect with each other. The forest is closer than you think. Find a forest near you and start exploring at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Mama, what does the chicken say? Dog. Cat. Giraffe.
Giraffe, really? Giraffe.
You're not going to get it all right.
Just make sure you nail the big stuff, like making sure your kids are buckled correctly in the right seat for their age and size. Get it right.
Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
To protect her home and family in a disaster, Karen was willing to wade through water, mud, and insurance paperwork.
Yeah, I can do this.
You go, Karen! By simply understanding and updating what her insurance covers and doesn't cover now, she'll be better prepared no matter when disaster strikes. Learn other simple ways to protect your home and family before a natural disaster at ready.gov. That's ready.gov. A message from FEMA and the Ad Council.
If you can plan barbecues and weddings, you can plan to protect yourself from a natural disaster. Sign up for local alerts, prepare an emergency kit, and make a family communications plan. Get started at ready.gov/plan.
Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Morning Cannolis with James Centel is an independent product and has a joint sales agreement with Civic Media. Enjoy.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. My name is Jim Santel. Welcome to our weekend review, our analysis, and our discussion of the most important stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Going to be pursuing that broad agenda again this morning, a special morning, a special edition this morning, December 3rd, 2022, of Morning Cannolis. Why? Because this is our 25th show this morning. We're finishing up and beginning a next 6 months, finishing up 6 months, starting a next 6 months, perhaps beyond that, of Morning Cannolis every single Saturday morning from 9 o'clock to 11 o'clock. And always this morning, as in the past, taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. I am here in the Civic Media studios of the Shaw in Waukesha. That's 540 AM, 101 FM. I'm here with my highly professional and always engaged producer, Kelvin. And together we are taking your phone calls, your observations, your comments, and your questions this hour and again next hour. Because this is a special day, a special observance, our 25th show, the conclusion of our first 6 months on the air of Morning Cannolis. We're going to adopt a slightly different agenda this morning. Always ambitious, but always achievable. And so this morning, unlike in past mornings, we're going to dispense with our discussion of what happened in history and go right to some of the major news stories. We're going to start with a couple of stories that comment on the rule of law in America, coming out of our courts once again, our federal courts in particular. And then at the end of our second hour, we're going to finish up with what's going to be coming up this coming week before the United States Supreme Court. Two major cases also in the area of the rule of law, one having to do with civil rights, the other having to do with elections and voting in America. Who decides elections? Who decides about the voting processes and procedures? Both of those cases coming up this coming week in the United States Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. We're going to finish up our time together this morning talking about those with some special commentary from me about their meaning. We're going to begin again with special commentary, thoughts on two significant events this past week, again, coming out of our federal courts. We're going to begin with this major ruling coming out of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. This, of course, one of the many courts of appeals in America, just below the highest court in the land, the United States Supreme Court. And obviously an in-between court, if you will, between the district court, the trial court, and that highest court of all. We know that this past week, a federal appeals court in Atlanta, that is coming out of the 11th Circuit, removed a major obstacle to the criminal investigation into former President Donald Trump's hoarding, his acquisition, perhaps his use of government documents that ended an outside review of thousands of records that were seized by by the FBI from his home in Mar-a-Lago, his office in Mar-a-Lago, and effectively freeing the Justice Department and the newly appointed special counsel, a fellow named Jack Smith, to use them as he and his staff goes forward with its inquiry into whether or not there have been violations of law, the Presidential Records Act, the Espionage Act, other particular federal statutes that have been the subject of that investigation. We're going to talk this morning, again, depart from our normal procedure this morning, not talking about past history, but present history, and providing you with some specific, very articulate expositions by the 11th Circuit judges about the rule of law. And the point of this is, if anybody today is still concerned about the legitimacy of this process, about the application for the search warrant, about the review by judges, the analysis by the Department of Justice, this 21-page memorandum, this 21-page order from the Court of Appeals effectively puts all of that to rest. It is a great read. It is accessible. It is understandable. And the judges, the three judges, about whom we will talk more in just a moment or so, have done a superb job of providing yet another lesson in civics to all of us in America. And it's for that reason that I'm spending most of this first segment talking about that major case coming out of the 11th Circuit just this past week. It's a unanimous opinion. It's unsigned. It's 21 pages, as I said. A three-member panel of the Court of Appeals in Atlanta shutting down this lawsuit that was litigated by former President Trump, basically stopping for at least three, perhaps even 4 months, slowing this inquiry into whether he illegally kept these national security records at his Mar-a-Lago residence and obstructed the government's efforts to retrieve them. You will recall from our past broadcasts, our past discussions about this, that a part of the released affidavits suggested that there was obstruction along the way, something that's often forgotten in our focus on this case. The appeals court, as you will hear this morning, sharply critical of the decision way back in September, about a month after the search warrant was initially issued by Judge Aileen Cannon, C-A-N-N-O-N. She was a judge who sits in the Southern District of Florida. Again, that's the lower district court in Florida, to intervene in this case at all. The court, as you're going to hear, basically said that Judge Cannon never even had a legitimate jurisdictional basis, the power, the authority to order the review or bar the investigators from using any of these files. No justification, they said, for treating Mr. Trump differently from anybody else in America. And that's one of the two major takeaways. That is, the former president is subject to the same laws, the same rules, the same restrictions as all of the rest of us. No one above the law. And secondarily, that this entire process, this entire civil challenge to the legitimate criminal investigation that's been pursued, frankly, for a couple of years now, all of that was baseless and without jurisdiction. So let's talk about what exactly it is that the Court of Appeals has done. And yes, I'm going to provide you this morning, because it's such good writing. It is such a wonderful exposition of the process here, beyond just the specifics here, that everyone needs to hear this and everyone needs to understand it. The opinion, once again, very much accessible online, easily accessible. This comes from the Chief Judge of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. His name is Pryor, and along with a couple of other judges named Grant and Brasher. All three of the judges issue what's called a per curiam opinion, P-E-R, new word, curiam, C-U-R-I-A-M. What does that mean? Basically, it means that the judges issuing this order in unanimous agreement, even with a three-judge panel from time to time, you will have a dissenting judge. And here, these judges, looking at this case, as we know, for a second time, come to the decision unanimously. No disagreement here at all. The things we're about to say in the next 20 pages that they have written are in agreement and state with great exposition exactly what they wanted to say in concert with one another. They say at the very start, provide some basic background into all this. Said this appeal requires us to consider whether the district court, that is Judge Cannon, had jurisdiction to block the United States from using lawfully seized records in a criminal investigation. And here it goes. This is the second sentence of this major opinion. The answer is no. couldn't be more clear on that, couldn't be more explicit in the rejection of virtually everything that the lower court has done in this case, including entertaining this case from the get-go. Goes on to say, these disputes ignore one fundamental question, which were raised by the parties, whether the district court had the power to hear the case at all. After all, federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction, the court goes on to say. They possess only that power authorized by the Constitution and statutes, which is not to be expanded by judicial decree. This case was such an expansion. That is a real statement to the lower court that what you have done is a power grab, if you will, sort of in colloquial terms, and plainly indicating, as the judges went on to say, our precedents have limited that this jurisdiction is subject to a four-pronged test. We're going to talk about that this segment and the next segment as well, because, again, great exposition about the things in which the court wrestles in coming to this conclusion. In considering these arguments, that is the arguments of the parties from Mr. Trump and by the government, the United States Department of Justice, the court went on to say, we're faced with a choice. We've got a choice here. Goes on to say, we can apply our usual test, which is applicable to every single American citizen, regardless of their statute, or drastically expand the availability of equitable jurisdiction for every subject of a search warrant. In other words, if everybody has this opportunity to come in, we can do that as well. Or we can carve out an unprecedented exception in our law for former presidents. Those three. Those are the alternatives. And the court goes on to say, we choose the first option, so the case must be dismissed. And again, in the following pages, basically pages 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, a huge amount of exposition, much of which has been in the news, about how this case got to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, what happened at the lower court, and in particular, all of these efforts made between the time that Donald Trump left the White House in January 2021 until now to try to get back the National Archives, trying to get back the records that he took, regardless of whether they're classified, things subject to the Presidential Records Act, attempts made by asking, writing letters, filing requests with counsel for the former president, seeking and getting a subpoena from a grand jury to produce those. In response to that, the Court of Appeals opinion goes on to say, an exposition by the attorneys for Donald Trump that we've complied with all of that. We've responded to all of that, which, again, we know is not true. And again, during the course of this initial exposition of the facts behind all this, the court eventually says, even as this attempt to recover all these documents is going on, the Department of Justice and the FBI in particular continuing to assemble evidence that indeed there are still more documents that have not been produced voluntarily, subject to the subpoena, subject to request. And for that reason, the United States Department of Justice went to a federal district court judge and secured a search warrant for the search and the seizure of materials at Mar-a-Lago. Goes on to describe, in fact, the specifics of that warrant issued way back in early August that justified under the Constitution exactly what happened here, and describes all of that and ultimately notes that on August 8th, it's just been that long, August 8th, the FBI executed the search warrant, about 13,000 documents obtained, even after months and months of attempt to get all those back, 22,000 documents altogether, including about 100 so-called confidential documents marked secret or top secret. And again, the court goes on to say that as it reviews all of this matter, including the civil request to basically stop the investigation for the appointment of this special master, there are standards to be applied. And the court articulates those and goes through in the following 20 pages the specifics of that. Right after the break here, we're going to be talking about exactly what the Court of Appeals said and what it didn't say in this shutdown of this major civil litigation, also telling the lower district court judge that she was wrong from the start. Stay with us here in Morning Cannolis as we discuss this major case in American jurisprudence.
We work, the kids' practices, household errands. Seems like every hour's rush hour at our house. But no matter how busy things get, we still make balanced nutrition a priority with help from Country Hearth Natural Breads. Whole grains and other natural ingredients are carefully blended and baked into delicious, nutritious breads like Dakota Style 12 grain, multi-grain, and 100% whole wheat. There's a Country Hearth favorite for everyone in the family. Country Hearth Breads, baking our best for you.
WAUK will be broadcasting the Waukesha Christmas Parade live, and you can become a sponsor. Call us at 262-232-8164. Sponsorship includes an on-air interview during the live broadcast of the Christmas Parade. A portion of the proceeds goes directly to the Waukesha Memorial Fund. Please call at 262-232-8164. That's 262-232-8164.
You care for the house, the kids, and our future. A Shiro's day is never done. So let's start saving a little more now. Get free tips to help boost your retirement savings. Visit aceyourretirement.org.
Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
We stand on the shoulders of women who came before us.
Women who fought for their own financial futures.
And now it's our turn.
Join us. Visit wesaysaveit.org and take control of your financial future by saving for retirement.
A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Sunny skies and calm this afternoon with highs around 26. Westerly winds 15 to 20 miles an hour. Lows level off around 17 tonight. Clear skies. Sunny skies and calm again tomorrow. High of 36. Upper 30s Monday with mixed precipitation possible at times. Turning cooler Tuesday with highs in the low 30s. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 19 degrees.
WAUK 540 AM, Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
We are back. We are talking this morning, Morning Cannolis, December 3rd, 2022, about a major decision issued just this past week by a major appeals court in our land, bringing to an end these months of civil litigation initiated by the former president to stop the investigation of the Mar-a-Lago case, to stop the investigation by the Department of Justice, determining whether or not there were any criminal crimes committed as a result of the taking, the acquisition, the possession of those documents at the Mar-a-Lago residence. Just before the break, I was providing some information about this wonderful opinion, which is in itself a tremendous civics lesson for all of us about how courts work and about the kinds of things that they bring to the analysis, which the 11th Circuit did in this case in shutting down the former president's claims that somehow he is being mistreated, that the Department of Justice is behaving in a way that's inappropriate with the Constitution or with the laws, and the Court of Appeals will have none of it. Also along the way, finding that Judge Eileen Cannon, in her appointment of a special master, a judge named Raymond Deary out of Brooklyn, all of that improper from the very start, and the Court of Appeals cutting through many, many initial arguments by the parties and saying there's a fundamental notion here that we've got to address that takes care of everything else, and that is that there's no jurisdiction. A civil court, the appeals court finds, has no jurisdiction to enter into this fray, to review these kinds of things, noting again in the middle of its opinion as it gets into its analysis that only the narrowest of circumstances, the court says, permit a district court to invoke what's called equitable jurisdiction. Lots of this language proceeds upon that fundamental notion. Decisions must be exercised with caution and restraint, as equitable jurisdiction is appropriate only in exceptional cases where equity demands intervention. What does equity mean? Well, usually it's the kind of the quality of fairness or impartiality. It's kind of what we think about in the normal sense of that word. Remedies and procedures in a civil case, different from the statutory, maybe constitutional standards would otherwise apply. Ensuring that fairness is done, that something is accomplished in an impartial way. That is the invocation, if you will, by the attorneys for the former president, and also by Judge Cannon, who is struggling along the way to find the basis for her to act in this case. Again, the Court of Appeals rejecting those. It goes on to say it is a familiar rule that courts of equity do not ordinarily restrain criminal prosecutions. And that's in page 11. You could basically stop the opinion there if you would like to. But the Court of Appeals does take seriously all of the arguments presented by the former president to avoid unnecessary interference with the executive branch's criminal enforcement authority, the Court of Appeals goes on to say, while also offering relief in those rare instances where a gross constitutional violation would otherwise leave the subject of a search without recourse. In other words, equitable jurisdiction only where some extraordinary needs, some extraordinary intervention by judges is required. This circuit, the 11th Circuit, as have most other circuits in the country, this circuit, the court goes on to say, has developed an exacting test for exercising equitable jurisdiction over suits flowing from the seizure of property. It's called Ritchie versus Smith, R-I-C-H-E-Y. The court refers to this as Ritchie throughout its extensive, but once again, very accessible and understandable order. Four different standards, and here they are. We're going to talk about them each very briefly. Much more exposition, much more wonderful articulation in this great opinion. Here are the four standards that the court applies in determining whether or not it's got equitable jurisdiction to even hear this case in the first place. And again, spoiler alert, not too much of a spoiler in this opinion, because it's announced from the very first pages, no jurisdiction here at all, no power, no authority. The standards are these: where the government displayed a callous disregard for the plaintiff's constitutional rights. That's number one. Number two, where the plaintiff, in this case Donald Trump, has an individual interest in and need for the material whose return he seeks. That's the second standard. The third one is whether the plaintiff would be irreparably injured by denial of the return of the property. And fourth, whether the plaintiff has an adequate remedy at law for the redress of his grievances. And most of the remainder of the opinion takes each one of those in order and determines whether or not there's any there, any basis for finding that any one of those standards has been met here. The court begins to say in its first exposition of each of these standards, the plaintiff makes arguments that if consistently applied would allow any subject of a search warrant to invoke a federal court's equitable jurisdiction. And that once again underscoring this notion that no one is above the law. If we permit jurisdiction in this particular case, then everybody who is subject to a search warrant, subject to seizure under the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, would have this access. And I should note, as the Court of Appeals does, that there is a remedy here. There's a remedy after someone is charged in a federal court, after someone is indicted by a federal grand jury, and this evidence is going to be used against them in a trial and other proceedings. It's at that standard, at that stage, that you can, in fact, ask for the judge to review the results of a properly executed and issued search warrant. That's what the court is basically saying. We're not going to open up the doors to all of those kinds of things, especially since there is a remedy already available to you. Court goes on to say, we'll begin with whether or not there was a callous disregard for the president's constitutional right. The callous disregard standard has not been met here, and no one argues otherwise. That's on page 13. District Court's entire reasoning about this factor was that it agrees with the government that, at least based upon the record, there's not been a compelling showing of callous disregard, dismissing that first standard out of hand very, very summarily, very quickly, nobody disagreeing about that one. Second factor, where the plaintiff has an individual interest in and need for the material whose return he seeks. What about this claim that he's got a personal, private interest in these materials? Goes on to say very clearly, plaintiff, that is, former President Trump, has made no such ruling. His jurisdictional brief in the district court asserted that the government had improperly seized his passports and that his continued custody of similar materials was both unnecessary and likely to cause significant harm. The district court goes on to say, the appellate court goes on to say, that the district court was undeterred by a lack of information, a lack of basis there. It said that based upon the volume and nature of the seized material, the plaintiff has an interest, and at least some interest in a portion of it. The court basically says this argument unresponsive and not appropriate, dismisses that second standard as well. Third standard is whether it's irreparable injury by the denial of the return of the property. Once again, not at all in the docket, in the attention of this appeals court. Right after the break, I'm going to tell you more about that and then finish up with some wonderful exposition here. Stay with us.
The Shaw 101 FM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
Women hear a lot about self-care these days. Advice on ways to relax, exercise, eat healthy, and more. Those are all great. But one of the most important self-care steps we can take is making sure we're financially secure later in life. That means saving money for retirement. It's never too late to start. And it's the kind of self-care that brings peace of mind that lasts. For small steps you can take to save for retirement, visit WeSaySaveIt.org. That's WeSaySaveIt.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I'm Rick Smith, host of The Rick Smith Show. And we are now on the air in Waukesha, live weeknights, 8 to 10 p.m., right here on WAUK 540 AM, 101 FM, The Shaw. Turn on, tune in, and help us rebuild the American dream. Check out our website at TheRickSmithShow.com. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. Weeknights, 8 to 10 p.m., right here on WAUK 540 AM, 101 FM, The Shaw.
AP News, I'm Jackie Quinn. The National Retail Federation says buying was strong today on this Black Friday, and retailers are sensitive to consumers who are feeling the pinch from inflation. Kathleen Cullen is a senior director.
We're hearing from consumers that they are looking for sales and promotions. They are shopping at different brands than they would otherwise, and they're also considering discount stores.
At the Macy's flagship store in New York City, shoppers were back without pandemic restrictions. Our Rita Foley reports.
60% off fashion jewelry, 50% off select shoes, says Macy's. CEO Jeff Gennett says there's significantly more traffic on this Black Friday compared to the previous 2 years because shoppers feel more comfortable in crowds.
Police in Lumberton, North Carolina are searching for a gunman who fired a shot inside a Walmart store today. One person was injured. The Virginia Walmart manager, accused of killing six people before killing himself, bought the 9mm handgun Tuesday morning, just hours before the massacre. Authorities also say he left a list of grievances on his cell phone. Our Mike Hempen reports.
Andre Bing blamed others for mocking him. Bing also said he did not plan the shooting. Things just fell in place, like I was led by the Satan.
Authorities say it was a former student in Brazil who broke into two schools on the same street in Espírito Santo State, killing two teachers and a student today. Some people are traveling home from holiday gatherings. There is snow reported in eastern New Mexico and heavy rains in parts of Texas. COVID cases are back on the rise, and health officials say holiday gatherings could push those numbers above the daily average of 39,000. In World Cup soccer action, once again, the U.S. ends with a draw against England. This is AP News.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
So all you folks out there, if you haven't registered to vote, register to vote. Get ready to vote. There are so many things on the ballot this November, at our freedom, our liberty, and our way of life. But we'll get to all of that this evening.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m. on the Shaw 101 FM and WAUK 540 AM.
Courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand.
You hold my hand.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids.
We are back doing our Saturday morning review, our analysis and discussion of great stories in law, government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Thank you for once again joining me and my producer, Kelvin, here. We're at the studios of the Shaw in Waukesha, downtown Waukesha, taking your calls and questions as always at 844-967-2789. In our first segments this morning, this special morning when we're celebrating, observing our 25th show, 6 months being on the air, we're spending some time talking again about the rule of law and this wonderful, this terrific civics lesson being given to America, and yes, also to a lower district court judge, and yes, indeed, to a former president about what equitable jurisdiction is all about, and also the basis for acting to try to upset, to interrupt a legitimate criminal investigation. Court of Appeals out of the 11th Circuit this past week saying we're having none of this and we're shutting all of this down, dismissing this challenge, permitting the investigation to go forward. But over the break, we were talking about these various standards that the Court of Appeals is using under this Ritchie case in the 11th Circuit. The third among those is whether or not the plaintiff, in this case the former president, is irreparably injured by the denial of the return of his property. Once again, the Court of Appeals not missing any opportunity to put Eileen Cannon in her place, as the district court stepped in with its own reasoning where there was none before and identified potential irreparable harm that could arise. And the Court of Appeals goes on to dismiss all of that. As for records, the Court of Appeals says that may be otherwise sensitive. It cannot be, the circuit court says, that prosecutors reading unprivileged documents seized pursuant to a lawful warrant constitutes an irreparable injury for purposes of asserting equitable jurisdiction. Simply can't be. Once again, this notion that after 240 years of doing this, it simply isn't the case that you can step in and stop prosecutors from looking at the documents to determine whether or not there is a basis for a criminal prosecution review by a federal grand jury. Here, too, the Court of Appeals goes on to say, plaintiff's argument would apply to nearly every subject of a search warrant. The district court's unsupported conclusion that government possession of seized evidence creates an unqualified risk of public disclosure is not enough to show that plaintiff faces irreparable harm, dismissing that third standard under the Ritchie standards that it has articulated. Finally, the fourth of these standards, whether the plaintiff, again in this case the former president, has an adequate remedy at law for the redress of his grievances, goes on to describe some of that, saying that he would have no legal means of seeking the return of his property for the time being, and no knowledge of when other relief might become available. That's the position taken by the former president. Court of Appeals dismisses this again very summarily, saying this is not a sufficient justification, period. Goes on to say that under Rule 41, which applies after a case has been charged, you do have that possibility. You can go back into court and challenge the results of the search warrant. You can challenge the underlying probable cause for it, but not now. Plaintiff's argument, the appeals court says, would apply universally. Presumably, any subject of a search warrant would like all of his property back before the government has a chance to use it. Doesn't distinguish you, Mr. Former President, from everyone else in the United States of America. Goes on to once again to say that all of these arguments, all the arguments presented by the former president and embraced directly and indirectly by the lower court, are a sideshow. That's the court's word, not mine. The real question that guides our analysis, the appeals court goes on to say, is this is an adequate remedy for what? In italics. The answer is the same as it has been in the past. Plaintiff has not asserted that any right has been violated, that there's been a callous disregard for his constitutional rights, or that a substantial interest in his property is jeopardized in any way. If there has been no constitutional violation, much less a serious one, the 11th Circuit says, then there is no harm to be remedied in the first place. All of that coming to the conclusion that there's no basis here. And finally, a couple of very telling paragraphs, which, if nothing more, resound and provide us with civil instruction, criminal instruction about no one being above the law. I'm going to read this paragraph at page 20 of 20 pages altogether in its entirety, because it's so good to reestablish once again this notion that no one is above the law, including a former president, I would offer, including a present president, a sitting president. The Court of Appeals says this: only one possible justification for equitable jurisdiction remains, that plaintiff is a former president of the United States. It is indeed extraordinary for a warrant to be executed at the home of a former president. The 11th Circuit basically is saying, yeah, we recognize this is atypical. It's never happened before in the history of our nation. But not, the Court of Appeals goes on to say, in a way that affects our legal analysis or otherwise gives the judiciary license to interfere in an ongoing investigation. In other words, district courts, appeals courts, United States Supreme Court, not going to interfere, part of the executive function, not a judicial function, at least not yet. To create a special exception here, the 11th Circuit says, would defy our nation's foundational principle that our law applies to all without regard to numbers, to wealth, or to rank. What an amazing statement, appropriate statement, right statement to make, clearly establishing, again, no one is above the law. Finally, the Court of Appeals goes on to say this: the law is clear, period. We cannot write a rule that allows any subject of a search warrant to block government investigations after the execution of the warrant, nor can we write a rule that allows only former presidents to do so. Either approach would be a radical reordering of our case law, limiting the federal court's involvement in criminal investigations, and both would violate the bedrock concept of separation of powers. Accordingly, we agree with the government that the district court improperly exercised equitable jurisdiction and that dismissal of this entire proceeding is required. 21 pages of exposition by the United States Court of Appeals. A great lesson in civics this morning as we gather together to talk about that. What happens next? Court of Appeals opinion basically is effective now, but giving all the parties an opportunity. The case basically shut down. Effective next Thursday, we know that Raymond Deary still out there, presumably until this order was issued, reviewing all these documents, giving the president also a chance, if he so decides, to appeal this to the United States Supreme Court, hoping that he does not, knowing that in a previous case, before this same circuit, before the same United States Supreme Court, he got nowhere and was told, basically, we're not even entertaining this kind of challenge. If the president decides to go down that road, anticipate a Supreme Court supporting, once again, this very important, dramatic, but reasonable and balanced opinion by the 11th Circuit, shutting down after 3.5, almost 4 months of challenge to this search. And of course, all of this means that the investigation now goes forward. These tens of thousands of documents can, in fact, be reviewed now, not only for national security issues, but also to determine whether or not there has been a violation of the federal law in their taking from the White House, their acquisition, perhaps their use, all of that, a part of the Department of Justice's continuing investigation into the Mar-a-Lago incident. That now being supervised, as I said before, by Jack Smith, who is the newly appointed special counsel overseeing all of this. That, along with the January 6th matter, separate from the Mar-a-Lago matter, but also brings us to the second major rule of law event of this past week. Also a civics lesson for all of us. Just this past week, we know that a jury in the United States District Court in the District of Columbia convicted the leader of the Oath Keepers militia of sedition charges. That happened on Tuesday of this week. Plenty of signal to the Department of Justice that its victory is significant, and that also served basically to ratify the government's central claim in the case. That, of course, that the Oath Keepers here were, in fact, this militia attempting to put together a scheme to overthrow the government. They were successful in winning two convictions on this seditious conspiracy charge. The most serious and perhaps politically inflected was brought among these 900 other criminal cases also pending out there, people who were involved on the ground at the Capitol on January 6th. The guilty verdicts in this seditious conspiracy prosecution returned against this fellow named Stuart Rhodes. Again, he's the leader of of the Oath Keepers. He's the number one man in the organization, and one of his top lieutenants named Kelly Meggs, who ran the Oath Keepers Florida chapter at the time. Three lesser defendants this past week, their names are Kenneth Harrelson, Jessica Watkins, and Thomas Caldwell, were found not guilty of sedition, which is kind of a rare situation, given the fact that all charged in conspiracy. But everybody was convicted of at least two felonies and can expect to spend some significant times in prison. This is actually the first time a trial brought by the Department of Justice, again, among these many, many hundreds out there, that any jury has acquitted anyone of any charge related to January 6th. Attorney General, of course, responded to these successful verdicts, these successful prosecutions, and saying that the verdict in this case makes clear the department will work tirelessly to hold accountable those responsible for crimes related to the attack on our democracy. So why am I raising this? Well, not only is it a significant prosecution event of this past week, this is a huge, huge, the most important case brought to date in the wake of January 6th, criminal case by the Department of Justice, finding by a jury, a unanimous jury of peers, of people like you and me and others out there, looking at all this evidence and finding that indeed there was a basis for concluding unanimously that there was seditious conspiracy going on here. And the question now remains about four more Oath Keepers who are also still out there. They're still facing seditious conspiracy charges in another trial that's scheduled to begin next week. There's more of this going on. The question, of course, will a jury hold them accountable as it did these others this past week for sedition, even though none of these upcoming defendants were leaders of this group? This second batch of defendants coming up for trial, yes, this coming week, their names are Roberto Minuta, Joseph Hackett, David Morshall, and Edward Vallejo. They're originally charged with Rhodes and the others, but the trial judge, a fellow named Amit Mehta, who's presiding over all of this, decided that it was too cumbersome to try all nine of these folks together. So he severed the trials out. So he's doing them kind of in sequence. The evidence likely to mirror what happened before in the trial of justice past week, and we'll see how that may go forward. Prosecutors may, in fact, explain during this upcoming trial how Mr. Minuta, again, probably the lead defendant in this second batch of defendants, who is a New York tattoo artist, was serving as a bodyguard that day for Roger Stone, someone we know well from our recent history, and also a longtime advisor to President Donald Trump. And yet, there's yet a third trial of Oath Keepers set for February, and the defendant in that case have not been charged with sedition, but that group concludes among its group, Mr. Meg's wife, a couple from Ohio, and a former Broadway actor. All that coming up in February. And, of course, all of this a part of the government's response to January 6th. There is even more coming up, and that is in December 19th. There is yet another seditious conspiracy trial on the docket. Five members of the far-right nationalist group Proud Boys, another group out there, the Proud Boys, set to begin on December 19th. And like in Mr. Rhodes' trial, the Proud Boys case will probably focus on the organization's leaders, among them a fellow named Enrique Tarrio. He's the group's former chairman, and some of his top lieutenants from Florida, Washington, and Pennsylvania. Likewise, the government likely to present evidence based upon all sorts of messages exchanged among the Proud Boys. The government shows how the group moved increasingly toward violence to keep Joe Biden out of office. Likely includes some testimony also from two fellows named Charles Donahue and Jeremy Bertino. Both of them pled guilty in those cases, going to testify against their former co-conspirators, part of the government's case against the Proud Boys. All of that very, very significant as these cases go forward. And again, all of this in the midst of the government's continuing focus, not only on those who are focused on overthrowing our government on January 6th, but also a larger message that all of this premised upon the notion that this was not simply an engagement in legitimate political discourse, but rather instead a serious assault on our government. We're going to talk more about that and take your calls right after this break here on Morning Cannolis.
Hey, this is Matt from Design Garden. Remember when the internet was new? Back then you had to leave your house to start a business. Companies used to pay programmers bags of cash to get online. Now, small businesses can get online with a Facebook business page, or Squarespace, or Google My Business, or WordPress. But which tools should you use? Can you afford to go down the wrong path? Design Garden uses modern tools to build your website the right way. Find us online at design.garden. Again, that's design.garden.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
So all you folks out there, if you haven't registered to vote, register to vote. Get ready to vote. There are so many things on the ballot this November, at our freedom, our liberty, and our way of life. But we'll get to all of that this evening.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m. on the Shaw 101 FM and WAUK 540 AM.
Women get a lot of advice about self-care these days, but one of the most important self-care steps we can take is making sure we're financially secure later in life. For small steps you can take to save for retirement, visit WeSaySaveIt.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Bright sunshine this afternoon with highs around 26. Winds out of the west, 10 to 20 miles an hour. Clear skies again tonight. Lows level off around 17. Bright sunshine expected tomorrow. Highs around 36. Mixed precipitation possible at times Monday with highs in the upper 30s. More clouds than sun Tuesday. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 19 degrees.
A progressive voice from Beaver Dam to Kenosha. WAUK 540 AM. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
We are back for our final segment in this first hour of Morning Cannolis, talking about law, government, and the aspiration for justice in America, specifically in this segment and the previous segment, talking about the lessons taken out of these recent convictions, these judgments to be entered against the Oath Keeper leadership, including Stuart Rhodes, and then the upcoming additional trials against more Oath Keepers in the coming weeks and months, and more immediately on December 19th. This much-related prosecution of the Proud Boys and its leader, a fellow named Enrique Tarrio, also in the federal district court in the District of Columbia. The government recently giving us some insight into how that case is going to be presented against Mr. Tarrio and his four defendants. Their names are Ethan Nordine, Joseph Biggs, Zachary Rell, and Dominic Pozzola, that they instigated others and ordinary rioters to attack the police on January 6th, leading to a series of breaches of the Capitol security, as we all witnessed on that day. Specifically, prosecutors signaling what they're going to be presenting in that December 19th trial, saying this: on January 6th, these defendants, these Proud Boys defendants, sought to harness the actions of others to achieve their objective of forcibly opposing the lawful transfer of presidential powers. In doing so, the defendants used these individuals, the other individuals, as tools. Once again, tools, the word used by the government to explain what it is they're going to be presenting at this trial coming up in just a couple of weeks, and then more trials down the road. Seditious conspiracy trials resulting in findings by impartial jurors looking at this evidence, finding that indeed this is not just tourists on that day. This is not just legitimate political discourse. This is not just legitimate First Amendment protest. This is sedition. And again, significant that a finding this past week in our nation's history, in the annals of our government, that finding made by a trial jury just this past week. Perhaps more of those verdicts coming up in the weeks ahead. We are always delighted to take your phone calls, take your observations and questions. And that includes Joe from Madison, who's calling in this morning. Joe, welcome to our program. Your thoughts, comments, or questions?
Thank you very much. There's just three points I'd like to make and get your reaction to. The first one was in your introduction where you said that you're highlighting your 25th show, which is fabulous, and you use the language, perhaps you'll keep going beyond that. And I'll just say, Jim, oh, please don't leave. It's perfect to have you on Saturday morning for our judicial cannoli.
No intention to do so. We'll see how the reviews come back on that, but looking forward to a long longevity here. Thanks, Joe.
All right. Let's gaffer tape you to the chair on Saturday morning for us. Thank you very much. I'm curious to get your reactions to two points. The first one is, I believe you've been speaking about this, which is the kind of language that's used in this particular document that was sent out. And one of the points you mentioned was that in the very first paragraph, you said they have the language, the answer is no. It's not a nuance, this or that, or this. The answer is no. Period. Another area they were speaking about the judges' arguments, the lower court judges' arguments, and they described it as, quote, a sideshow. It seems to me, ouch. And then at another point at the very end, the language was used, the law is clear. So there's no nuance or fudginess about any of this stuff. And I'm curious if you think part of this is to just state it out so directly that you can't keep coming back to it. Not only for going out to the world and our country to sort of say this is how we view it, but also as a really big stop sign, as they mentioned several times within this, what you were describing, that anybody could then say, I want to stop the investigation because I'm going to be suffering irreparable harm. I need this material. It seems to me that those two things are interesting in terms of the kind of language was used and the fact of they got to put a stop to this or anybody and his brother can be doing the same thing, right?
Absolutely. And Joe, you should join me, as you often do on Saturday mornings, to expose just these kinds of comments you're making, all directly on point, spot on. So let's talk about the language once again. You bet. Courts of appeals, traditionally, and I've been on the receiving of more than a few courts of appeals that have disagreed with things that the government has done, also approving things that we have done during my time as in the U.S. Attorney's Office. Courts of appeals tend to be very moderated. They will use words like, we tend to disagree, we have a different view of things. That, Joe, as you just indicated, that's not this opinion. This court is saying unequivocally, the answer is no. That's the second sentence in this order, going on to talk about just the wild, my word, not theirs, the wild invocation here of jurisdiction where there was none, basically saying that the lower court should have known better. No nuance in any of this. All of this is a sideshow, absolutely. That's kind of the language you'd expect maybe in a radio talk show from time to time, but not necessarily from an appellate opinion that remains forever in our annals of government. Undeniably a statement to Judge Cannon and, Joe, as you indicated, a statement not only to the former president, to knock it off, if you will. Don't come back to us with these kind of spurious and, frankly, frivolous, a word they did not use the word frivolous, but could have used this word. Don't come back to us further. There's no there. There's no basis for doing this. And then the most important point of all, we've talked a lot about deterrence on this broadcast in the past. Deterring others. If you think this is a pattern for your future behavior, others out there, and there are thousands of people who, regrettably, every single week, every single month in this country are the subjects of search. This is not the remedy. You don't go in and file a civil lawsuit. You wait for your time inside a criminal prosecution. You don't do this. This is a stop sign, Joe, as you've just said, to everybody, not only to the former president, but to anybody who would think about doing this. And also a rebuke, if you will, to the lower court. Don't entertain this further. Get rid of this case, dismiss it, and move on. So undeniably picking up on that language again, not language that's completely unknown to an appellate court, but strong language also much in the media. These three judges, two of them appointed by the former president, President Trump himself, these are not folks who brought to this table a political agenda of their own. And these are folks who looked at the law and said this could not be clearer. And I would offer once again, the reason I've spent so much time on it this morning is because this document can be used, frankly, to teach civics. I realize a lot of this has to do with equitable jurisdiction, maybe things that people think lawyers love and are not beyond the scope of understanding. They're very accessible. And the language of this, shutting this down, is, in fact, a great civics lesson to those people who might think about going into our state and our federal courts, advancing these kinds of spurious and unfounded allegations, bringing this hopefully to an end, even as the legal woes of the former president continue. We were chatting again right before the break into this segment about the seditious conspiracy case, also having to do with January 6th. We know as well that that case brought by the Department of Justice, is a part of a larger view being taken by the Department of Justice of everything related to January 6th, that being still pursued, arguably against the former president and his aides as well. We're going to talk about that and other matters on the docket of America right after the break in our second hour this morning here on Morning Cannolis. Stay with us. Here, Civic Media's The Shaw, WAUK in Waukesha.
I'm looking at the phone lines. I'm seeing some familiar faces. Once in a minute, Gina Beauclair.
Well, welcome back, Matt. I really miss you. We've been missing getting woke every morning, but now we'll get woke in the afternoon.
Once in a minute, Andrew of Detroit.
Professor, it's so nice you're back. We missed you during your vacation, and I'm very happy to be in your class for the semester.
Thanks a lot for calling in. I appreciate all my callers.
Tune in to Matt Flynn Direct, Monday through Friday, 3 to 4 p.m.
Wake up and text. Text and eat. Mm-mm. Text and meet up with a friend you haven't seen in forever.
Hi.
Oh, hey.
Text and complain that they're on their phone the whole time. Text and listen to them complain that you're on your phone the whole time. Text and whatever. But when you get behind the wheel, give your phone to a passenger. Put it in the glove box. Just don't text and drive. Visit stoptextsstoprex.org. A message from NHTSA.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.